the opening verses for our Dhamma talk tonight are from the connected discourses of the Buddha, namely the Samyutta Nikaya, the first Samyutta, first collection, Sagata Wagga, namely the book with verses. And a very short discourse that consists of three verses, and out of those we shall discuss I'll give you two, and so the second one is the important one. Well, it seems that the time of the Buddha, and a young deva by the name of Chandana addressed the Blessed One in verse in the following way. Who here crosses over the flood, unwearying by day and night? And who does not sink in the deep without support, without a hold? And so the question is here, how to cross the flood? And how to do so without sinking, as there is nothing to hold on to in our during our journey through samsara. So it's like being in a deep ocean and having nothing to hold on to above, nothing to step on underneath, and nothing, no support from the sides. Now, the second verse is the one that interests us here most, and it basically, in a very succinct manner, describes the path to knowledge and liberation. And it is outlined as follows, namely, one, always perfect in virtue, endowed with wisdom, well concentrated, one energetic and resolute, crosses the flood so hard to cross. So what we have in the second verse are the ingredients that will lead us eventually to the realization of, that will lead us to the arising of knowledge and to liberation. And those ingredients are essentially virtue, or an ethical code of conduct in the Pali scriptural language known as sila, then as the second one, concentration, samadhi, even though it is mentioned here third, and then wisdom, panya, is the third major ingredient. And these three then are to be complemented by energy or effort, and this is expressed through the words one energetic, and on top of this we need to be resolute, namely we have to have a fixed aim or fixed purpose in our meditation practice. Now, when these ingredients, as well as a number of others that will be explained in the course of this meditation retreat, when these ingredients are present, then sooner or later they will lead a meditator to the realization of his or her aim, namely to cross the flood that is so difficult to cross. Now, among the different ingredients that they mentioned, clearly virtue, sila, concentration, samadhi, and wisdom, panya, are the most important. And they get mentioned in the Buddha's teachings again and again. Now, Since we are already somewhat advanced in time, and I don't want this talk to get too long, so I'll limit the explanations on sila to just some very basic aspects. Now, Sila or virtue is mentioned first among the three trainings, the three sekhas, since it is the foundation for the training in concentration and also the training in wisdom. Now, when it comes to the observance of an ethical code of conduct, then different sets are available. So there's as the minimum the set of five precepts, then we have the set of eight precepts that you have just taken, and then there's also the set of ten precepts as frequently observed by novices, and then we have the monastic vows of the monks and nuns. And virtue derives from a basic sense of humanity, and we should understand an ethical code of conduct not as something that has been handed down from generation to generation, but rather something that is based on a sense of humanity. Considering that before we do something or say something, then we reflect whether we would like to have something similar done to us or not. To give you an example for this, let's say we get really upset about something and then we are contemplating to maybe yell at another person or to go even further and maybe get physically active. So before acting out our anger or rage, we should then just briefly stop and reflect. Would we like to be in the position of the other person who is going to be yelled at or who might even be hit at? Obviously, none of us will like this, and as we don't like it ourselves, others will not like it either. So if we don't like it, others don't like it, then it might certainly be wise to refrain from such a planned deed. And likewise, we use this same yardstick of human behavior. With regard to any other activity that, if we're not careful, might lead to a transgression. So, just like we don't want to be hurt or harmed or beaten, likewise others don't like it either. And in the same sense, just like we don't like it if our property gets taken away without permission, others won't like it either. And then the same thing goes for sexual transgressions. So as we don't like to be the victim of a sexual transgression, likewise for others, they might not like it either. And just like we don't want to be subject to false speech, or we don't want to suffer others' false speech, likewise others will not like it either. And we might not like it when others are intoxicated and then talking a lot of nonsense. So too, others may not like it if we are intoxicated and as a minimum are talking a lot of nonsense and maybe doing many other things that later on we might regret. Now, apart from these very basic five or minimum five precepts, on a retreat, we tend to observe additional three precepts. And before mentioning those certain additional three precepts, let me point out that there is a difference between the third of the five precepts and the third of the eight precepts. And the third of the eight precepts is stricter than that of the third then of the five precepts. The third of the five precepts simply says that we should refrain from adultery, any kind of unlawful sexual relations. And the third out of the eight precepts states that we voluntarily refrain on retreat, as long as we're taking these certain eight precepts, from any kind of sexual activity, even with one's spouse or partner. Of course, after retreat, all of this, or after retreat, it's a different story, and then you're not bound by this precept. Now, the sixth precept is the one on not taking any solid food after midday, after noon, midday, and as Chris will have pointed out to you, we go by the actual, or whenever the sun is in the zenith, and this is past 12 o'clock summer time, or daylight savings saving time. And so if you could finish your lunch by, let's say at the latest, 12:45, then that would be perfect. And in this way, this precept would be well observed. Now, what this precept means is that we refrain from taking any solid food, like fruits and so on, from noon until the dawn of the next morning. And included in this are items such as coffee, and so we refrain from coffee, from black tea, and from green tea, and milk, and hot chocolate, and Milo, and what not. Allowable are, or permitted are, soft drinks and water and fruit juices, and and medicinal teas. And then the seventh precept is that of refraining from dancing, singing, and then playing instruments and entertainment, and furthermore, from wearing flower garlands and using cosmetics, perfumes, and ornaments. Now, the first, starting with dancing, singing, and so on, up to entertainment, has to do with not unnecessarily, causing, not stimulating the mind, and not causing the arising of, greed and desire, and so on. And Likewise, when we are on a retreat, we try to keep things simple, and there's no need to beautify ourselves externally as a means of getting others' attention, and this too then would amount to distracting other meditators. So on a retreat, we wear simple clothing, and we refrain from any makeup and external beautification. And what we'll see in the course of the meditation practice is that as we go on meditating and the mind gets purified more and more, then an inner beauty arises, and this inner beauty will then permeate our entire being, and it will also reflect externally. And so, in this way, we then discover a new type of beauty that by far excels the external beauty. And as the Venerable Sadhu Pandita, my teacher from Burma, keeps on saying, this internal beauty that comes, or inner beauty that comes with the meditation practice, is an adornment for all ages, for the young, for the middle-aged, and certainly even for the senior citizens. Now, the last precept is that of refraining from the use of high luxurious seats and beds. And the deeper meaning here is that if we were, or one has to understand this from an Asian context, where usually people of high social status would sit on higher seats or lie on higher beds. And this then, if one were to sit on a high chair or sleep on a high bed, this might lead a person to develop pride and conceit, and obviously this is not what we're attempting to do here on this retreat. Now, briefly mentioned a few things about in concentration, the second training, samadhi seka. By continuously making effort from moment to moment, mindfulness will gradually arise. This mindfulness will become quite sustained and continuous, and with this, then the mind will gradually fall, or again and again fall squarely onto the object of observation. And thus, the observing mind will be fixed to the object of observation, and to express it differently, the associated mental states will all be unified or collected. Hence, concentration is there. And so, during the first few days of a retreat, meditators usually come across the so-called five hindrances to progress. And it is through an increasing concentration that these then are overcome. And so concentration helps to suppress certain hindrances that are latent or that lie dormant in the stream of consciousness. However, the presence of concentration will not really entirely uproot the mental defilements that are causing us so much suffering in our human existence. Sorry. And so in order to take things then one step further, we need to undertake the training in wisdom. Panyaseka is the Pali technical term for this. And this means that we then, based on effort, based on some initial faith and then some effort and mindfulness and some concentration, we observe the predominant objects, the mind is concentrated, as said, and thus we'll see the true nature of every predominant object that we are observing. And seeing the true nature of an object means, the same thing as wisdom is there or knowledge is there. And so there's knowledge or wisdom about the nature of that object. Now, this wisdom needs to be developed. Without meditation, it will not be there. And it is said in one of the Dhammapada verses that with meditation, wisdom is gained. Without meditation, wisdom is lost. Now, with the training in virtue, we can cultivate towards the better our bodily behavior, our bodily conduct, as well as our verbal conduct. So we can substitute unwholesome conduct through wholesome conduct. However, through the observance of some ethical code of conduct, and we can not influence in a major way the arising of or the presence of the mental defilements. They will still go on in the stream of consciousness. So with the training and concentration, we can suppress these. And so this then happens only on a mental level. And it is through the training in wisdom that we temporarily and later on a permanent basis, eradicate the mental defilements. Now, the very basic maxim for that leads to the arising of wisdom or knowledge is simply, and this will be the meditation instruction for all of you until tomorrow morning, since we don't have the time tonight to go into the detailed instructions and most of you will be quite tired. So the very basic maxim is starting with the rising and falling movement of the abdomen, always try to, label and then observe and then know the nature of each and every, every most predominant object that arises either in the body or at times in the mind. So, to explain this just a little bit, so as the rising movement of the abdomen takes place, you stay with it, you label it mentally as rising, and then you observe this entire rising movement from the very beginning through its middle to its very end, and then you try to know its nature in terms of the different sensations that might be present, or in terms of the movement itself. And then And as the thawing movement of the abdomen occurs, you do just the same thing. You label it briefly as fawning or thong, and then you observe the entire fawning movement from start to finish, and then you try to know its nature again in terms of sensations such as a sense of relaxation, contraction, maybe some vibrations or some softness, and so maybe you notice a particular type of movement, and so on. And then as the next rising movement occurs and is predominant, again you focus your attention on this rising movement, and so then should some other predominant object arise, such as pain somewhere else in the body, and then let go of the rise and fall and focus your attention on the pain, label it as such as pain, observe it, know its nature, and once the pain is gone, then go back to your rise and fall. If some predominant state arises, such as wandering mind, then take that as an object, label that as wandering, thinking, whatnot, and then once it has ceased, then go back to your primary object. So that's the very basic instruction, which applies to the sitting meditation. In the walking meditation, it's basically the same thing. You try to be aware of the most predominant sensation as walking from one place to another, and kindly try to do so as slowly as possible and by restraining your senses. Now, more on this, as mentioned already, will be explained tomorrow. Now, when we undertake a meditation retreat, like our retreat, our 20-day retreat here at Vallecitos Ranch, it's helpful to be clear about the aim or objective with which we, or the aim and objective that we have for our meditation practice. And in the words of the Buddha, this something can be given in different ways. The most simple way, as Sadhana stated early on in our first verse or second verse, was to cross the flood so difficult to cross. And a similar verse is found very beginning of the Visuddhimagga, the path of purification, and there it's given us to disentangle this certain tangle that is brought about through the roots of unwholesomeness, namely greed, hatred, and delusion. Now, in a somewhat a more elaborated way, the Buddha gives the aim for the meditation practice as twofold, namely, as gaining true knowledge and the liberation, vijja vimutti in the Pali scriptural language. Now, more on this, and to quote from the Samyutta Nikaya, the Bodhyanga Samyutta, so it's 46, and then Sutta 6, and a discourse that portrays a discussion between the wanderer Kundalīya and the Buddha. And so this wanderer, Kundalīya, approaches the Buddha and asks him what are the benefits and the fruits of his teachings and his practice. And to this, the Buddha replies, and I'm quoting, "Kundalīya, the Tathagata, lives for the benefit and fruit of true knowledge and liberation. Vijja vimutti pala anisamsa in Pali. Pala means the fruit, and anisamsa is the benefit." Now, to this, the wanderer Kundalīya then asks, But, Master Gotama, what things, when developed and cultivated, fulfill true knowledge and liberation? And the Buddha answers, the seven factors of enlightenment. Kundalini, when developed and cultivated, fulfill true knowledge and liberation. Again, the Wanderer speaks, but Master Gotama, what things, when developed and cultivated, fulfill the seven factors of enlightenment? And the Buddha replies, the four establishments of mindfulness. When developed and cultivated, fulfill the seven factors of enlightenment. But, Master Gotama, what things, when developed and cultivated, fulfill the four establishments of mindfulness? And to this, the Buddha points to three kinds of good conduct. When developed and cultivated, fulfill the four establishments of mindfulness. Now, the Wanderer in Kundalini is not giving in, and his thirst for knowledge seems like never ending. And so then he asks, but Master Gotama, what things, when developed and cultivated, fulfill the three kinds of good conduct? To this, the Buddha answers, in Kundalini, it is restraint of the sense faculties developed and cultivated so that it fulfills, or that leads to the three kinds of good conduct. And in detail, having seen an agreeable form with the eye, a meditator does not long for it or become excited by it or generate lust for it. And his or her body is steady, and his or her mind is steady, inwardly well composed and well liberated. But having seen a disagreeable form with the eye, he or she is not dismayed by it, not daunted, not dejected, without ill will. And a meditator's body is steady, and the meditator's mind is steady, inwardly well composed and well liberated. And then it goes on in basically in a reverse order, and then towards the end the Buddha says, it is in this way that the seven factors of enlightenment are developed and cultivated so that they fulfill true knowledge and liberation. So, to sum all of this up, what we have here is actually a causal series of links. And starting with the restraint of the senses, and tomorrow this will be explained to some extent, and then leading to good conduct, to the three kinds of good conduct, namely by body, speech, and mind, by abandoning unwholesome conduct, by body, speech, and mind. This then contributes to the arising of the four establishments of mindfulness, which in turn then generates the arising of the seven enlightenment factors, and the seven enlightenment factors lead us all the way to true knowledge and then also liberation. So, this much for the twofold aim or objective that the Buddha gives for the meditation practice. Now, then, in the commentaries, we find a threefold aim for the meditation practice, namely as purity, as knowledge, and as nibbana. And so the Pali for this is visuddhim jnanam nibbanantitayo visese avahati. And The commentator says that these certain instructions, that certain meditation instructions, in particular the instructions on given in the discourse on mindfulness, establishment of mindfulness, these should be studied, they should be mastered, they should be borne in mind, and they should be memorized and be made much of. Now, this threefold or triple aim is already somewhat more detailed than the twofold aim. And it specifically mentions purity or purification. And it also specifically mentions Nibbana, which comes or which is part of the liberation experience. Now, the topic of purity or purification is certainly part of a sevenfold aim or benefit that is associated with the practice of Satipatthana, namely the four establishments of mindfulness. And so the first one, the very first benefit is given as the purification of beings, and certainly in a wider sense this means the purification of the minds of beings, and then it further is said to lead to the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation. It's also said to lead to the total destruction of physical pain and mental distress, and to the entering of the right path, namely the Eightfold Noble Path, and the attainment or the realization of Nibbana. So, this is a sevenfold aim as given, aim or, and or benefits that are being ascribed to the mindfulness practice. Now, when we practice the meditation, then we should do so mostly with these aims, different aims in mind. And naturally there are other aims around. Some people practice certain meditation because it helps them to reduce stress, or it helps them just for general, for good health, or general sense of wellness or well-being. These are secondary. And please don't turn, don't be contented with these secondary benefits, but rather life is short and human existence is rare, so you might as well shoot for what really matters. Now, other benefits or aims that could be associated with the practice of Satipatthana are the following, namely, the seed of the Dhamma has already been planted here in New Mexico and a number of bordering states, and as far as Canada, Toronto and Vancouver, and so this seed of the Dhamma then needs to be nourished. And one way of doing this is through attending a meditation retreat and developing one's meditation practice more and more until one realizes, until one gains those benefits as given or mentioned by the Buddha. And so we need to nourish this Dhamma seed that has been planted, and we need to allow it to grow into a Dhamma sapling, and then from there into a Dhamma flower or some Dhamma plant or tree, and so hopefully even a strong one. And longer retreats are very useful for this, because they help the meditator to really deepen the practice and to reach faces of one's or aspects of one's insight knowledge that usually during shorter retreats are difficult to access. Now, another an aim that we can maybe have for our practice here together is that of gaining peace within. And actually this peace within comes quite naturally with the meditation practice. It's a byproduct, and the Buddha himself has referred to Nibbana as Shanti Sukha, namely the happiness of peace. And Once more peace has been established within ourselves, and then this serves as a contribution to peace in our families, in our respective families, to peace in our community, respective communities, to peace in our respective nations, and in the end it will be a contribution towards certain peace in the world. Now, this much regarding some of the aims with which we can undertake this meditation practice. And the Buddha also mentions six very practical obstacles that might make it difficult for us to gain the benefits of the practice. And he says that while we are undertaking the mindful contemplation of the body, of feelings, of the mind, and of dhammas, then we might be fond of activity, and this then figures as the first obstacle. And so while we're on a retreat, we should try to refrain from any kind of activity that is not related to intensive meditation practice. Just to give you an example of something that is not related, such as giving a massage to some other meditator, or maybe exploring the forest around here and trying to figure out what kind of birds can be found here, and so on. And then the next obstacle to our mindfulness practice is to be fond of talking, and so instead of talking we try to observe noble silence as much as possible. However, if we need to know something, some practical things, or of course during the interviews, then we say whatever needs to be said, but we try to keep our talking to a bare minimum. Next, the next obstacle to the practice of the four establishments of mindfulness is simply sleeping. So sleeping a fair amount, such as 4 to 6 hours, is okay, but overdoing it, like sleeping 8 to 10 hours, might be counterproductive. Now, having said this, you're all tired, so tomorrow morning, if you make it for breakfast, this would be wonderful. And then the Buddha gives yet another obstacle to successful meditation practice, and that is of seeking company. So as meditators, you know, we're kind of alone, together, you know, with others, but not in the sense that we, you know, communicate with one another through talking or in other, you know, ways, or by writing each other, you know, others, in each other notes, but instead, we, you know, stay alone and we just do our own meditation practice. And then what may interfere greatly, you know, with the intensity of our, you know, practice is a lack of a restraint of the senses, and which means that, well, we're, you know, walking around, looking here, looking there, enjoying, you know, the, you know, really tempting, you know, beauty of the nature around here. And what this will do is it will distract the mind, and it certainly may lead to the arising of some unwholesome mental states that then otherwise, with proper restraint of the senses, wouldn't arise. And then the last and difficult to resist obstacle is that of immoderate eating, especially when the food is really good. And now, when we are on an intensive retreat, you know, we tend to, you know, or we try to eat only as much as we need to sustain, you know, this body, to, you know, keep it going, to, you know, remain, you know, healthy, and to have enough strength to, you know, do, you know, the meditation practice. But any kind of eating that is done to develop one's muscles, or, you know, or simply just indulging in the food because it's so good, and Beth is supposed to be a good cook, and John definitely is a good cook. You know, this I know. You know, this would certainly then be it would be a hindrance or an obstacle to, you know, the meditation practice. Now, having indulged in, you know, too much food, there are consequences to this, and usually, you know, the consequence occurs in the form of a nodding head during the next sitting meditation. Now, during an intensive meditation retreat, the attitude with which we practice matters a lot. There are a number of attitudes that are somewhat not that useful, somewhat counterproductive, and there are a couple of attitudes that are helpful and to be cherished. Now, among the wrongful attitudes are those of having high expectations regarding to one's meditation practice. And let's say you've had some wonderful experience during some past retreat, and then you're expecting to regain that, or to re-experience that same condition or situation. And another and somewhat related to this is setting, planning out one's certain practice and setting deadlines. So knowing this retreat is only 20 days long, so by day 10 I should have reached at least the fourth insight knowledge, and when the last and 20th day comes, Nibbana should be mine. So if you think like this, if you expect or plan like this, then it may not happen as you expected. So rather, kind of try to desist this certain kind of thinking, and simply just do the practice, and everything else will happen all by itself. We don't have to be worried. We don't have to worry too much about progress all the time. And then, growing up in a rather competitive fitness society, so people are used to competing with each other in school and university and on the job. When we then come to meditation center, we do just the same thing. And so even though we don't talk to our fellow meditators, yet we still, or at least some, still might find that they compete with another meditator. Maybe having overheard some statement during the interview, another meditator reports something, and then one thinks, oh my goodness, I haven't, what is this person reporting? His or her practice seems like far out. And my own practice is not that developed, and then one starts competing. So there is no need for this. Or if you happen to see a meditator sitting in meditation, in deep meditation for 2-3 hours, and you have a hard time sitting still for 45 minutes, and then please don't compare. And your practice is your practice, and the other meditator's practice is his or her practice. And people are not necessarily all at the same point. Now, another wrongful or unproductive attitude is that of trying to force one's practice, trying to make one's practice happening. And so there's a lot of self or ego involved, and this in Pali is the term apta, and so this is not helpful. And instead, we should assume an attitude of simply just doing the practice and letting things unfold of their own accord. Sorry. Now, sometimes meditators make life very difficult for themselves by resisting the meditation method, or by resisting for one reason or another the meditation teacher, or by resisting the retreat center or the venue, or it could be many other things. So if you find that you've fallen into this, then kindly just take this mental resistance as an object itself and be mindful of it as much as possible over and over again until finally it passes. And so if we are patient enough, simply just to do the practice, and then after overcoming some initial difficulties, then sooner or later things will, the practice will unfold quite nicely, and then you'll see that this meditation or this mindfulness practice is really working and is really yielding good benefits. Now, before speaking about wholesome attitudes, let me just remind you of the preciousness of retreat. And two aspects in this context. The first one is, namely, that only the coming together of many different factors make a meditation retreat possible, such as this one. And in order to really have a retreat, we need good organizers, and then we also need good cooks, and we need a suitable location for the retreat, and then the meditators themselves temporarily need to renounce their worldly commitments in terms of a family or job or whatever else there may be. And then of course a teacher, some guy, is all also necessary. And only when these different conditions are present can does retreat really take place. And there are many things that can go wrong. And just so to keep in mind that we started planning for this retreat maybe 4 years ago. And then among all locations, retreat locations, the stillness and the nature here at El Vallecito's ranch is quite remarkable. And so the stillness, the quietude of the place, there's hardly any man-made or human caused noises here, except for occasionally some plane flying flying by overhead. So the quietude is of tremendous value. So is the fact that we're really in the midst of nature, surrounded by a huge by the huge Carson National Forest. So, being aware of the preciousness of this very retreat, and there's other, of course, other points that make for the preciousness of this retreat, we should then adopt helpful attitudes towards our meditation practice, such as making good use of our time, and so we have no time to waste here, and to be as diligent as possible in our practice, and to practice with an utmost or maximum patience, and then also to practice with consideration for our fellow meditators and also the staff here, the people who are running the retreat. And when we meditate, then it's really best to do so with a relaxed state of mind, relaxed and or yet alert state of mind. So there's no need to force in any way. And then also we need certain goodwill towards certain others and certain a fair amount of determination. Naturally, it's not always going to be smooth sailing. In the Satipatthana meditation is known to have its certain ups and downs. However, overall, the meditation will lead us to deeper and deeper levels of knowledge. Now, other helpful attitudes are simply in our practical observation of objects, simply to accept and observe whatever object comes along, whether we like it or not, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, whether it's painful or unpainful, or whether it's painful or free of pain, it doesn't matter. And so then when we practice to do so without expectations, without any deadlines, and so, also to practice with a wholehearted and balanced effort. And what does help a lot is to practice with care and respect, or we could even go as far as saying with some religious devotion. So just to think of some highly devoted person and who says or does his or her prayers. Likewise, we should do our practice with a devotion to what is occurring, to all the details, and so on. And then we should try to be as meticulous as possible in our observations, since this in the long run will make a huge difference, and being meticulous in one's observation will usually make for clear experiences, and with this a meditator will be satisfied and feels confident to go on. And as expressed, already a certain amount of flexibility towards the meditation method. To some of you, this Mahasi style of Vipassana meditation may be new or different from what you're used. And since there's two teachers here on this retreat, the style of guiding meditators may be slightly different. And so from a meditator's point of view, trying to be flexible and trying to learn from whatever is being offered in terms of advice. Now, this then brings us to the conclusion of our opening talk tonight. And let me end by wishing that may this retreat, as outlined earlier on, may it lead all of us and to the development of more and more knowledge, deeper, ever deeper knowledge, and to may it eventually lead to our gaining of liberation from the mental defilements that cause so much suffering. And this is it for tonight.